Good afternoon. My name is Steve Luckemaw, and I'd like to welcome you to the Drug Interactions and Managing HIV-HCV Co-Infection Webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the Partnerships for Care HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, or HIV-TAC. The Partnerships for Care project is a three-year multi-agency project funded by the Secretary's Minority AIDS Initiative Fund and the Affordable Care Act. The goals of this project are to, 1, expand provision of HIV testing, prevention, care, and treatment in health centers serving communities highly impacted by HIV. 2, to build sustainable partnerships between health centers and their state health department. And 3, to improve health outcomes among people living with HIV, especially among racial and ethnic minorities. The project is supported by the HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, or HIV-TAC. Our speaker today will be Dr. Christopher Keyes. Dr. Keyes is the co-founder and president of the Clinical Pharmacy Associates Incorporated and co-founder CEO of Mednovations Incorporated. He is a licensed pharmacist, clinical pharmacist, and educator who received his Bachelor's of Science in Pharmacy from Howard University College of Pharmacy and a Doctor of Pharmacy degree from Philadelphia College and Pharmacy. And he is board certified in pharmacotherapy. Dr. Keyes completed his advanced training as a research intern with the Food and Drug Administration and as a clinician at the Washington Hospital Center. His professional accomplishments include directing both the clinical drug studies for Washington Area Research Group and the clinical pharmacy and drug information program at Greater Southeast Community Hospital in Washington, D.C. Dr. Keyes has served on the boards of the Washington Metro Area Society of Hospital Pharmacists as president of the Drug Use Review Board for Washington, D.C., and the Chesapeake Research Review, Incorporated. He has also been a member of the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research Group on Clinical Practice Guidelines. Dr. Keyes is a clinical preceptor at the University of Maryland and holds an adjunct associate professor faculty appointment at Howard University College of Pharmacy. He serves as a clinical consultant to the Washington, D.C. Department of Health's Administration for HIV and AIDS Policy and Programs. He has served as a research fellow at the Howard University Center for Minority Studies and Healthcare Services, and he has lectured and published in the areas of drug information, therapeutics, HIV/AIDS quality improvement, medication errors, formulary management, telepharmacy, and patient safety. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Keyes.
Good afternoon, and I thank you for that introduction. I welcome you to the presentation on drug-drug interactions between direct-acting antivirals and antiretroviral therapy in HIV-HCV co-infected patients. I'd like to recognize the collaborative work of my practice fellow, Dr. Chen, in the completion of the material for today's presentation. Just by way of disclosure, we have no conflict of interest to disclose with regards to today's presentation. We're excited to be able to discuss what is an extremely timely and important topic. It is a vast and complex topic that has immediate implications for the care of HIV-infected individuals, and it's vital knowledge for anyone who's involved in assisting patients in HIV treatment. But we have some specific objectives for today, and they include to identify the basic epidemiology of chronic hepatitis C infection and chronic hepatitis C and HIV co-infection in the population, to recognize the availability and clinical importance of newer direct-acting antiretrovirals in the medical management of chronic hepatitis C and its co-infection, to identify and discuss the importance of these new direct-acting agents and antiretroviral drug interactions in the management of patients with chronic hepatitis C infection and co-infection. To identify and utilize basic pharmacology and pharmacokinetic information to minimize drug interactions in the care of our patients. And then lastly, to recognize and support medication management strategies that limit drug interactions and adverse health outcomes for our patients. We won't spend a lot of time on pathophysiology or epidemiology, but let's just highlight a few important epidemiologic facts regarding chronic hepatitis C and the hepatitis C virus. It is estimated that 2.7 million persons in the United States have chronic hepatitis C virus infection, and this includes all genotypes, which include 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Approximately 75 to 85% of people who become infected with hepatitis C virus develop the chronic form of the infection, and this would be as opposed to what we see in the case of hepatitis A or hepatitis B. I would add that on a global level, there is estimated to be over 170 million people infected with the hepatitis C virus, as well as, so you see it as a global problem as well as an important infectious disease and public health problem here in the United States. Regarding screening, people have risk factors in the community, and there are important for screening of high-risk individuals as well as all patients who are HIV infected. Displayed before you is a characterization of the frequency of risk factors in the majority of patients infected with hepatitis C virus. IV drug abuse or IV drug users is by far the leading category at 60% of the estimated infections, and sexual exposure-related transmission, as well as other types, which include occupational exposure and perinatal exposure, round out the pie chart with respect to the risk factors. Let me also hasten to remind you that recipients of blood transfusions and organ transplants before 1992, when we had no reliable screening methodologies to detect the hepatitis C infection, is another risk factor. And in the last couple of years, the CDC has called for testing for baby boomers, those born between the years 1945 and 1965, in as much as the incidence of hepatitis C infection in the population born in those years is about five times higher than any other adult population and represents about 75% of all of the hepatitis C infected individuals in the United States have born in that period that we refer to commonly as the baby boomers. About 50 to 90% of our HIV infected individuals who have IV drug abuse are co-infected with hepatitis C virus, as it is the most common mode of transmission. Depending on your population, it may vary, but overall, about 25% of all HIV-infected individuals in the United States are co-infected with hepatitis C virus. Important to note, in terms of the seriousness of that statement, that there are some prognostic factors that we would like to remember with respect to the co-infected individual. First of all, there's a lower rate of spontaneous clearing of the virus after the acute infection due to the low CD4 counts present in the HIV-infected population. So just to punctuate that point, a portion of the population in general, maybe 15% or so, will clear spontaneously the virus and not go into a chronic state, but that rate of clearance is diminished in individuals who are HIV positive. The co-infected individual has an accelerated risk of hepatic fibrosis, which is a poor marker for outcomes, including after transplantation or liver transplantation to be exact. There is a higher rate of liver decompensation seen in the co-infected individuals, especially in the absence of antiretroviral therapy, and these include conditions such as ascites and spontaneous bacterial peritonitis seen in the decompensated co-infected individual. And as you would expect, higher liver-related mortality rates are seen in HIV-infected patients. In some data sets related to risk of mortality, hepatitis C represents the single highest cause of death in the HIV-infected population in the United States, depending on the source that you're reviewing. So we have a host of newer agents that came onto the market in 2011 that fall into this category of drugs we refer to as the direct-acting antivirals for the treatment of chronic hepatitis C. And just briefly, we classify them by their site of activity. And so I'm going to just briefly share some of the nomenclature related to those classifications as they've been heralded as a dramatic improvement in our armamentarium for the treatment of chronic hep C, both in the general population and in the co-infected individual. So in 2011, we had the introduction of both bocipravir and telaprevir, which are both classified as NS34A protease inhibitors. When given in combination with the standard therapy at the time, which was pegylated interferon with ribavirin, we saw substantial improvement in the what we target as the ultimate projector or measurement of probable cure, which is sustained virological response, and we saw a dramatic improvement with these two new agents. In 2013, we obtained newer direct-acting agents, and here cimiprivir came on the market, also known as Elicio, and also we saw sofosbuvir, known as Sovaldi brand name, that was approved by the FDA. You can see that we've had a very active, what we call, drug development pipeline with respect to these drugs, because in 2014, continuing on the great developmental work that had been done in the management of this infection, we see that we have the introduction of a combination pill known as Harvoni, which is a combination of lenacapavir and sofosbuvir, and followed by the end of 2014 by another combination, which was actually a two-part combination drug for treatment of chronic hepatitis C, which is abidosvir combined with paratapervir and ritonavir, and that's one product. The co-packaged in the same treatment with an agent called dazaprevir, and that whole product combined is known as the Vicara pack. That was brought on the market in December of 2014. And then just this year, during the summer, we saw FDA approval of two newer agents, which fall into this direct-acting antiviral class, which are known as the Cladisphere or the Clinza, and the combination drug, which you should recognize when I mentioned Vicara pack, but it's missing the dazaprevir, and that is in your slide referred to as abidosvir, paratapervir, and ritonavir, which we know under the brand name of Tecnavi. So you can see that there has been a very robust onslaught of new and exciting direct-acting antiviral agents that have ushered in a new era in our management of both chronic hepatitis C in the mono-infected patient as well as in the co-infected patient. Some of the slides and the information we'll share will be overview to keep us all together with some core principles around the pharmacology and the therapeutics of these drugs, and then we're going to interject as much as possible practical applications of that information. So with respect to the management of the co-infected individual, we really had in the beginning in 2011 when we saw the introduction of tenofovir and baciprovir, the first group of oral direct-acting agents, we saw a real difficult introduction of those therapies into the treatment regimens for the co-infected population. And a predominant reason for that was the many drug interactions that were observed or that were characterized between those newer agents and our antiretroviral therapies. We also saw significant side effect profiles, which made it difficult and sometimes too difficult to produce reliable treatment adherence regimens and outcomes in our co-infected individuals with tenofovir and baciprovir. But that being said, there were also problems in the beginning in that FDA approval was not present for either of those two new agents with respect to the co-infected individuals, as well as it was difficult to have good evidence to incorporate that information into our national guidelines, which in my last bullet on the left of the slide highlights the U.S. Public Health Service guidelines, as well as the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, as well as IDSA, which is the Infectious Disease Society of America. So we have some nationally recognized expert guideline documents that we seek clarity around the safe and effective management of the co-infected individual who has the chronic hepatitis C, and we were challenged heavily around the evidence in part because of these drug interactions. On the right side of this slide, and it's mostly for your visual consumption, is we introduced the major drugs within the different classes of antiretrovirals on the left side of the slide, meaning the NRTIs, such as abacavir, the NNRTIs, such as efavirenz or Sustiva, the protease inhibitors, such as atazanavir or Rytaz, and the entry as well as integrase inhibitors, drugs like dolutegravir or Tivicay, as well as drugs like Ravirac or Selzentry. So these represent our major armamentarium of therapies to treat our HIV infection. On the right, you see at the top in abbreviated forms, SIM for cimiprivir, DCV for the cladisphere, SOF for sofosbuvir or Sovaldi, as well as you see the combination drug, which is Harvoni, which is second to the last. And then the last one known as 3D is an abbreviation for Viekira-Pak. What's useful about this slide is that while you're looking to the antiretrovirals, you want to note the landscape, how much green is on the chart, how much, if you will, light pink or pale, and then how much is on, along the reddish shade. Red refers to contraindicated drug interactions. The lighter pinkish color is where there's a dose adjustment requirement or close monitoring. And then green is where we have evidence that there appears to be no significant drug interaction with respect to these combinations. And so I do want, just for simplicity, for you to note the drug at the top that's SOF, sofosbuvir, which is Sovaldi. As you look down, you'll notice for all the antiretrovirals, it's green, suggesting that these drugs, particularly from a what we call pharmacokinetic interaction standpoint, look quite clean. Whereas you can see that a drug to the far left, cimiprivir, which is Elicio, it being a NS3A4 protease inhibitor, it has a lot of drug interactions with some of our major therapies to treat HIV. So this is just one way for us to recognize we have some data, substantial data, which gives us some real warnings around the relative frequency of significant drug interactions associated with some of our major direct-acting antivirals. I will spend very little time speaking about the first-generation oral antivirals. That is bosiprivir. I mentioned it as a 2011 approval, an important new addition that did eradicate chronic hep C for many patients, but very few HIV co-infected patients. So bosiprivir and telaprevir I will not really mention much throughout this presentation because telaprevir is now off the market. Its disuse has prompted that withdrawal, as well as there is bosiprivir, which is still on the market, but now relegated to a largely historical drug with respect to the new direct-acting antivirals. And in fact, we anticipate in December for bosiprivir to be removed from the market as well. Not to panic about a technical diagram of this nature, but this is just a couple of quick reminders regarding the hepatitis C virus life cycle. And up in the upper left-hand corner, we have the virin. It's required to attach to a cell. In this case, it's a hepatocyte, which is a liver cell. And you're looking at the orange outer membrane. It has to attach to that membrane. It undergoes endocytosis to be taken into the cytoplasm of the liver cell. Within the liver cell, this is a virus that must undergo replication within the hepatocyte, and you see that there is a process that's underway within the cell with uncoding, translation, processing, RNA replication, the reassembling of the virin particles, the maturation inside the liver cell, and then the discharge, if you will, from inside the cytoplasm of the liver cell back into circulation as a new virus. So this replication is taking place, and this is obviously the area where we must have some targeted therapies to address the infection itself. Keep in mind that our earlier historic treatments, which included, as I mentioned earlier, interferon products and ribavirin, neither of those are recognized as direct acting against the hepatitis C virus, though they are an important part of some of the combination regimens that are being used today. So just to settle in on the thinking a little bit more, you'll often hear reference, there's a lot of important distinctions between the drugs that we were talking about, that we're going to talk about drug interactions with. And so this is just a slide to speak to the fact that we have exploited our knowledge of the different, what we call non-structural proteins that are found in the hepatitis C virus. And so you see reference, you see various diagrams, NS2, NS3, NS4A. These are non-structural sites of protein sites that are being targeted by our antiviral therapy to disrupt viral replication, maturation, and recirculation. And so we have some overlap between the drugs in this regard, and so not to remember specifically where they act on the non-structural proteins, but to be clear that they are acting within different target sites on the viral synthesis process to disrupt and result in the death of the cell. And these are very powerful agents, keeping in mind that the virus that's found in circulation is magnitudes higher than the HIV virus that we see, and as much as our patients who have chronic hepatitis C often have our viral loads that are in the millions as opposed to the thousands or 100,000s as we typically see with HIV. So just some practical information that's worth spending a few minutes on with respect to these drugs. If you're used to these therapies, then this will be a quick review. If you've not much experience with these agents, then this may be more helpful. So just some more common drugs, just to quickly show you the cimiprivir or Lisio, which is still being used in practice. This gets us to the point of remembering that all direct-acting antiretrovirals against the hepatitis C virus are not indicated for all genotypes. This is an example showing that genotype 1 and 4 is where cimiprivir is indicated, meaning that's what it's approved to be used for by Food and Drug Administration based on its safety and efficacy trials. And it must be given in combination regimen, as do all of these drugs. If it's not been said, it should be noted that like HIV, hepatitis C virus does require at minimum two drug regimens, and part of that is to achieve not only viral suppression, but to reduce the chance of viral mutation and resistance, which would be a major reason for treatment relapse in this population. You can see it's also, most of these drugs are given once a day, and I'll mention where they're more frequent, and there may be a requirement with respect to food. The next drug, Sovaldi, which if you see any of these patients, this is a very common drug used, and at one point in the U.S., this was the most combination drug regimen for chronic hep C, was Lisio with Sovaldi, worked by two different mechanisms. But Sovaldi is a polymerase inhibitor, and it covers multiple genotypes that are found in the community with respect to types of hepatitis C infections. It itself is given in combination regimens. It's worth noting that it is one of the first drug that got the FDA approval for not only the mono-infected individual with or without cirrhosis, but it got the indication for the co-infected individual. And you see here's a once-a-day dosing, and there's comments here regarding dosage adjustments in patients with kidney and liver impairment. Harvoni has become a dominant drug in the care of the chronic hepatitis C infection. It is not a stated indication to use it in co-infected individuals. We are aware there is a landmark study, and so that's come out that has supported its use and its high efficacy rate in the co-infected individuals. So we do see many programs and practices where their Harvoni is being used in the HIV co-infected population, and this is specifically Harvoni for the genotype 1, which I failed to mention before, but is the most common genotype associated with chronic hepatitis C infection. Again, this is a fixed dose combination once a day, and it's convenient in that it doesn't need adjustments for mild to moderate degrees of kidney or hepatic impairment. And then for hepatic, it doesn't need adjustments for any of those degree of impairment. Viqiropac, which is a product that is also approved for the co-infected individual with genotype 1, is actually a four-drug regimen. And one of the drugs you may recognize as ritonavir, which is, of course, what we refer to as a boosting agent. It has no antiviral activity of its own at this low dose, 10 milligrams or 100 milligrams, but it is used because it allows for the increased absorption and achievement of higher blood concentrations, which are needed with other agents in this combination regimen, in particular is paratamavir. So hopefully you recognize ritonavir as a drug that used in combination with our HIV protease inhibitors, such as Ryataz or atazanavir or zoranavir, which is Provista. And then the two newest drugs, which I mentioned, were just approved this summer. And by the way, approval doesn't mean marketed, and so it takes sometimes a little while to be marketed. So these drugs were approved in the summer, but not immediately available. I believe that they are available now or around this period. I have not seen an individual patient receiving them yet. But the Cladisphere or Declinza is an NS5A protein inhibitor. Genotype 3 is specifically indicated for, and it has not been approved for the co-infected individual, but it's important to note that there has been at least one study called the ALIVE trial that did show it to be active in co-infected individuals, and it's likely that the cleanser will be used in many patients for which genotype 3 treatment is being targeted with co-infection. And then Technive is a combination drug as well for genotype 4, which is infrequent in the population, but it is an important drug because it represents one of the only combination regimen when given with ribavirin that can avoid the use of interferons or an injectable immunostimulant, which is pegylated interferon. So Technive is not studied or known to be active or inactive yet in the co-infected individual, but as you'll see soon, the drug interaction profile of this combination regimen, Technive, makes it a very challenging drug to use effectively and safely in the co-infected population. Again, more for your visual, not for detailed consumption around the mechanism, but it's important to remember a couple of principles. First of all, most drug interactions that are referred to when we talk about antiretrovirals as well as antivirals for hepatitis C are due to pharmacokinetic interactions. And those pharmacokinetic interactions reside largely because of the impact of different drugs in these classes on what we call proteins that are associated with inducement of metabolism of drug or inhibition of metabolism of drug. And just to back up one step, when we refer to pharmacokinetics, we're referring to what we call the five phases of how a drug is handled by the body. And if you think about an oral therapy, taking a pill, a tablet, it undergoes first a major phase is called absorption. Once it's absorbed into the body or simultaneously it's being distributed through the body, that's distribution, which is the second phase. The drug itself will undergo metabolism, most of these drugs, which means it's being biotransformed primarily to break down and eliminate the substance. Sometimes it undergoes biotransformation to be active and then subsequently to be broken down. And then the last phase is excretion, which is elimination of the drug or the breakdown products of the drug from the body. For these drug interactions we're talking about, for which there are many, the vast majority of the drug-drug interactions within these two classes of agents are due to the pharmacokinetics, and most of it resides at the level of metabolism of drugs. And at the metabolism of drugs, we have what we call protein or enzymes, and I'll refer to them a little bit later, and we have transporters, and the slide reveals that in case of enzymes, we may have something that needs to attach to an enzyme, and if something inhibits it, it blocks the ability for it to attach, that alters its metabolism, or sometimes there is something that will not block the site for the product or drug to attach, but it will change the conformation or the structure so that it cannot receive and attach appropriately. In either case, whether it's happening extracellularly, which outside the cell, intracellularly or inside the cell, or at the level of the cell membrane, we have a potential for there to be a pharmacokinetic interaction. And I think it's pretty common knowledge that we have with respect to antiretroviral therapies for HIV, as well as antivirals for chronic for hepatitis C, we have what we call a therapeutic range, which is the concentrations that are needed to prevent replication of the virus vis-a-vis result ultimately in blockage of replication and death of the virus. And there are concentrations, if it's too low, it won't work, and it may even induce resistance by the viruses. If the concentration is too high, it may very well be effective at inhibiting viral replication, but it also is associated with more toxicities. So we have this therapeutic range that we target in clinical care of patients, as well as in our research studies. And it's important for us to know about drug interactions because if there are products that if patients are concomitantly receiving, and if those concomitant therapies are inducing or inhibiting the way the body is handling the drug, then we have a real chance of there being a lack of effectiveness or increased toxicity and or the inducement or creation of resistance patterns. This is a slide that looks real complicated, but I have a theme that I just want to share. How do we generate knowledge about drug interactions? I think that sometimes it's hard to actually believe that drugs can interact in a way that's predictable. Some of us see the studies and so, or conducted the studies, and so we're a little bit more comfortable with that concept. Others can treat patients and never see a problem or what it perceives to be a problem with an interaction, so you can get to a point where it's not believable. But this is what happens in early investigation of the direct-acting antivirals that we've been talking about, where we conduct sample pharmacokinetic studies. And this is an example of looking at paratacrovir and ritonavir, two of the agents that are in several of our, a couple of our products like Vikira, PAC, and Tecnavi. And what we see here is a patient who are being exposed to several different drugs, all to compare what happens to the blood concentrations, those what we call those therapeutic levels, those blood concentrations, when we introduce a second drug. So they're on paratacrovir, and then we introduce a drug like fibrozole, which is for cholesterol lowering, or ketoconazole, which many of you may recognize as an antifungal. But the one I really want you to pay attention to is carbamazepine, which is an important anticonvulsant, less popular today than in the past, but it's also used for a number of other conditions, such as tics and other neurologic disorders. Carbamazepine happens to be what we call an enzyme inducer. And you can see with paratacrovir, we would expect the levels to be right here around the middle line going down like many of the other drugs are. But in fact, you have what we call a much lower concentration of drug in the body, in the blood specifically, because of the fact that carbamazepine has been given to that individual as called inducement of the enzyme. Specifically, the enzyme is called cytochrome P453A4. And it has resulted in a dramatic drop-off in the blood concentrations of paratacrovir because of the presence of that carbamazepine. Ritonavir, it's similar and actually even more dramatic in terms of the drop. Roughly an 80% drop in the blood concentration because of the inducement by carbamazepine. But also important to notice, many of the other drugs that were tested, sleep agents like Ambien, diuretics like furosemide, cardiac drugs, that they didn't have an effect. So we use this methodology of healthy subjects getting tested with two drugs to determine pharmacokinetic interactions as one of our ways of getting at a very important question, which is, are there drugs for which they disrupt the blood concentrations, the tissue concentrations that we seek? And if that is so, we really need to know that, because unlike a few of our drugs, we do not follow blood levels of our direct-acting antivirals in clinical care. So your patients do not get sent typically to a lab to measure levels of, let's say, Sovaldi or Harvoni. So we must use our preformed knowledge and our clinical acumen and our knowledge of pharmacology to identify how we handle these in advance and what we do if we suspect interactions. Okay, this slide is useful for showing pictorially. No one's got to memorize these kinds of interacting issues, but here is a slide that deals with the topic I've already talked about, which is the pharmacokinetics, the absorption, distribution, metabolism, elimination. I think I said earlier that there's five. There's only four phases, so those are the four. And so what you should readily see is that when you look on the far left column and you look at the antivirals, you'll note that there are substrates, they're metabolized by and they're inhibited by different items. What I want to point out, these drugs have many what we call pathways by which drug interactions can occur. Smipivir or Lisio would be a classic example of that. Each of these represents a protein pathway that can be interfered with, that can change either smipivir's blood concentrations or the other drug that it's being combined with. P, glycoprotein, breast cancer receptor protein, organic acid transport protein, etc. CYP3A4. All when you see this kind of activity of drugs that can interfere with the pharmacokinetics of any product, you know that there are a lot of drug interactions, and it's got to be carefully addressed in the care of patients. So fosbuvir is kind of on the other end. You can see that there are only two here, and the second one is really not that significant. So P-glycoprotein is one that we pay a lot of attention to. It doesn't have CYP3A4 challenges. So only P-glycoprotein, that's dramatically different than simeprevir.
just to use examples, you can see that Arvoni, which is a combination of sofosbuvir and another agent, ledepasvir, has also a very small profile with respect to which pharmacokinetic interactions could occur. Vicura PAC, on the other hand, significant number of potential interactions. Doesn't mean the drug is bad, has nothing to do with whether the drug is bad or good. It has more to do with what we can combine the therapy with and what we have to do to properly and safely manage the patient. The new agents from this summer that we just talked about, the Cladisphere, some interactions are present enough that this is a caution, a drug that has a significant number of potential drug interactions. We have a summary of the drug direct acting agents and antiretroviral interactions, and that slide that I introduced earlier on that was color-coded in green, red, and pink is a great slide for visual recognition of classes of antiretrovirals that are going to have significant or potentially significant interactions with the direct acting agents. Just as a general reminder, most of the nucleoside and nucleotide reverse transcriptase inhibitors do not have many interactions. Tenofovir on the side when I say that for a moment, but in general, that's true. Most of the interactions that occur are occurring with the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, which includes ritonavir at low dose as a boosting agent, and the entry agents such as Selzentry, as well as the integrase strand transfer inhibitors like Ascentris or raltegravir or Tivicay, which is dolutegravir. So just as a general thinking that those are the groups of antiretrovirals where we have metabolic interactions that are substantial for many of these agents. And having said that, we're not going to go through every detail in the chart, but I do want to take time to talk about a few that are being used in practice. Cimiprivir is difficult to use in a co-infected individual. You can see that the antiretrovirals like efavirenz or Sestiva or a Sestiva-containing regimen such as Atripla, as well as some of the other agents that are listed there, problematic, including Stribil, which is a, you know, four-drug combination monotherapy. And because it has not ritonavir as a boosting agent, but it has cobicistat, which is another boosting agent like ritonavir, but with really, really no antiviral activity at any level. Any ritonavir-containing combination is problematic, in large part because these are agents that interfere with cytochrome P453A4. You can see here the mechanisms, and so these are predictable problems. Some of them, though, cause induction, which means the enzyme system speeds up and drops the levels of cimiprivir. Some of them are inhibition, such as cobicistat and ritonavir, and we see levels going up in our research studies, predictably go up, not in everyone the same degree, but they typically go up. And when you see numbers like 350%, that means more than three and a half times the levels that we see in individuals on cimiprivir who aren't taking ritonavir-containing combination drug. And again, I dwell on this because it is not an uncommon observation in clinical settings for drug interactions to be not easily recognizable in clinical care and difficult to believe if you've not encountered any significant drama around a patient in terms of treatment failure, which is hard to detect if it's a drug interaction because we're not following the levels of the direct-acting antivirals. It would be more likely to be detected if it was a toxicity that was dramatically increased in a population. The clinicians would pick that up much quicker than they probably would drop it in levels. So in all these combinations with Lisio, just to read this complete, there are no significant effects on antiretroviral therapy. That's a great thing, and that's part of the reason why we tend to need our studies in the HIV community population as well, because there are examples of drugs that negate high infective activity of the drugs in clinical care. And so combination class of antiretrovirals and antivirals, but it's important to be aware that in addition to the pharmacokinetic interactions, which we tend to be able to visualize because we can draw blood levels in research settings, have less capacity, but need to be observing in studies whether pharmacodynamic interactions are occurring. Those are interactions that manifest largely outside of the realm of absorption, distribution, metabolism, and elimination, and they are principally associated with things that happen at receptor sites that can block activity, or they can antagonize activity, or they can. So that being said, our pharmacokinetic principles are most important in the discussion of today's subject of drug interactions, but we, at the end, we'll see an example one case where it's not a pharmacokinetic interaction that's suspected, but a pharmacodynamic interaction, which is more related to the effects of the drugs on tissue, organ, receptor sites that changes the pharmacology of the way the drugs perform. Bottom line, for Cimeprevir, and I'm going slow on this one because this is a good example of the significant drug interaction story between these two classes. Bottom line, it's antiretrovirals work with this agent, but there's many drug interactions. So the groups that are listed in the far left, the antiretrovirals are not recommended to be co-administered with Cimeprevir because of what we discussed, the effects on blood concentrations increasing or decreasing. And I'll go more quickly through these slides because we've kind of made the point, but I will share with you that Sovaldi is used in the co-infected individuals, and the drug interaction profile is cleaner as it is with Harvoni, but particularly with Sovaldi. The problem, and something to always remember, if someone's only on one drug for chronic hep C infection, there's a problem because these are not infections where we treat with a single drug. We may treat with a single combination drug, but not a single drug. But here, what does stand out is tipranovir with ritonavir can decrease the sofosbuvir levels, which you won't know in clinical practice because we're not measuring them. So it is recommended to avoid. And fortunately, there's not a lot of tipranovir used in most settings that I'm aware of. And so and it's not a preferred protease inhibitor in the treatment guidelines from the Public Health Service. So that's a good thing. Harvoni, which is very popular as the patterns emerge in the way treatments are being done, and it's highly recommended within the guidelines for the settings where it's indicated. And as I mentioned, it is a drug that's used in co-infection, though FDA labeling doesn't specifically state that fact. The guidelines do. And so we can see there are some drug interactions. And I want to dwell on tenofovir for a moment because I put that aside earlier when I was talking about nucleotides and nucleosides. And tenofovir does seem to be an increase in tenofovir concentrations because of this Harvoni combination. And so we need to be cautious. Co-administration is not recommended with Stribilt. And, of course, tenofovir is in many products, and Truvada leading the way probably. And we would want to be mindful that what we mostly are worried about with tenofovir being elevated is acute kidney injury or kidney disease associated with increased levels of tenofovir. You can see the other recommendations on this page. I want to go to another drug, so let's go to the next page. So Viekira Pak, and we haven't talked about cost at all, but as we'll talk about in some slides to come, there is some important discussions around what clients will have access to, and Viekira Pak comes up. A couple of reasons. One is because it's FDA approved in a co-infected population for specific genotypes. Genotype 1 is specifically one of them. And you can see that there are, because it has paritaprovir, which is affects many of the pathways we talked about, many of those non-structured, many of those proteins, and it's ritonavir, which is a major drug when it comes to interfering with metabolic pathways, and even the sapuvir and obisbitavir have some drug interactions. So we have some significant concerns around antiretroviral combinations. We need to dose atazanavir alone without giving ritonavir booster if they're on Viekira Pak, and that should be obvious because they're already getting ritonavir. So otherwise, you'd end up with, an example would be someone on Provista, which is atazanavir combined with ritonavir, either alone or in the new combination known as Subix. We would not see these two together because if you're on two different products, and that would be the case if you just went ahead and combined someone who had been on ritonavir-containing atazanavir regimen, and then you gave them Viekira Pak, you would have too much ritonavir on board, so that's to be avoided. Ralpivirine is one to remember because it is an inducer, like carbamazepam or the 3A4, and it's not recommended. Dolutegravir, which is available both alone and in Stribilt, be inhibited by ritonavir, and so there's not recommended to be given together. And Selzentry or Maraviroc can be inhibited by ritonavir and not recommended to be given together. So we do have the ability to use Viekira Pak in our co-infected population if we manage our antiretroviral regimen successfully. Declenza, as I mentioned, not specifically FDA approved for co-infected individuals, but there's at least there's one trial that's published and speaks favorably, as well as the guidelines from the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease and IDSA. They do have a place for this in the management of genotype 3 chronic hep C, and you can see there are some concerns that result in dose adjustment in combination with atazanavir to drop the dose, and there's a type where it should be the cladisvir, to drop the dose to 30 milligrams, or if they're on efavirenz or etravirin regimen or alone or in a combination, induces the metabolism resulting in loss of levels. So per FDA guidelines, we actually increased the dose from the usual 60 to 90. Fortunately, the cleanser has a 30 milligram and a 60 milligram tablet approved. So we can do the 30 milligram easily. We can do the usual 60 milligrams when there's not a drug interaction that's an inducer. And we can go up to 90 by giving a 30 and a 60. But as you might imagine, that doubles the cost. You may not notice, but it doubles the cost of very expensive therapy if you have to use a 30 milligram tablet and a 60 milligram tablet to reach the 90 milligram dose for someone on efavirenz or etravirenz. Now, we've been talking about direct acting agents in combination with antiretrovirals. Because our HIV patients are often on other therapies, we clearly attention to them, and this is not a presentation to go through all the other potential drug interactions associated with the direct-acting antivirals, but just some examples that are worth noting very quickly. When patients are on ribavirin, which is a combination used with drugs like Viekirapak, it's a pregnancy X category drug, and so women have to be with effective birth control. So oral contraceptives is one of those, and it has some drug interactions that we have to take into account. Similarly, if we have immunosuppressive therapy for our transplant patients, they're drugs with very tight, what we call narrow therapeutic margins, such as cyclosporine and tacrolimus, and so we must be mindful of the drug interactions that can emerge in use of our direct-acting antivirals. Depression, seen easily with interferon-based regimens that are for treatment of hep C, and that's something that still can be used, although it's declined a lot in practice. We have to be concerned about inhibition drug interactions. Individuals who are, we mentioned IV drug abuse is a high risk for hep C condition, and those who are on methadone maintenance programs, it's a CYP3A4 substrate, so interactions have to be considered. And obviously, this product has a narrow therapeutic margin with inhibition of CYP3A4 causing methanol levels to go up, and you can have an opiate overdose. Digoxin, some of our patients, particularly our older patients or patients with heart failure arrhythmias, may require digoxin. We fortunately can follow blood levels clinically in the practice setting because of some drug interactions that can occur with our direct-acting agents. The statins, like Lipitor and Crestor and all of these statins that we have, clearly some of them are being used for just patients with comorbidities or hypercholesterolemia, but we also may see individuals who are receiving the statins to manage the hyperlipidemias associated with the antiretrovirals, such as many of the protease inhibitors or the boosting agents like ritonavir. And so we need to be aware that there can be a substantial drug interaction in statins, which can have difficulties with tolerance. In some people, they can be a serious risk of things like rhabdomyolysis. If both of some of the statins go too high, they can cause muscle kidney injury and put patients in hospital if it's extreme. And then our patients who are on prophylaxis for opportunistic infections, particularly Biaxin or clarithromycin, but azithromycin is a little less, is less of a problem, but we do have interactions there that we have to be mindful of, as well as if patients are on azole antifungal agents like fluconazole or ketoconazole or the like. So when we have two drugs, we have a tighter story of how to manage drug interactions. If we have three, four, five, the research tends to be not robust enough to greatly predict the consequence of a multi-drug interaction. And so in that case, we have to use our training and skill, and we have to try to navigate away from as much as possible. In the early slide, when we were talking about the objectives of today's presentation, we used the term, which is commonly used in systems approach to medication, which is called medication management. And medication management has a few major steps involved. The first one is prescribing, the idea of selecting an agent that's appropriate for an individual. And we've been speaking today principally around the drug interaction concerns, and therefore that's a dominant reason for the prescriptions or the orders that will be placed to treat patients with direct-acting antivirals in the co-infected state. We also want to remind our listeners that we have to know what the genotype is. We need to know it's consistent with FDA labeling, and usually it's consistent with FDA labeling and with guidelines such as the Public Health Service. In the case of management of chronic hepatitis C, much of the Public Health Service references to the American Association of the Study of Liver Diseases and IDSA, which are leading the way in the incorporating evidence-based guidelines into the practice of managing the chronic hep C individual. We do have to pay attention to comorbidities in addition to the HIV status. Prior treatment is an important consideration. The stage of fibrosis is usually weighted in terms of the risk-benefit because it is an important prognosticator of the advanced conditions of hep C, which can include, obviously, cirrhosis. Out of administration, important consideration. Prior to 2011, our regimens were based on injectable regimens led by interferon. Today, our regimens are principally oral, and there is some combination with both. Duration of treatment is an important part of the consideration, and drug interactions. This could affect, drug interactions can affect the duration, but we typically have durations based on standard evidence, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 24 weeks, 48 weeks, depending on the clinical setting. Contraindications and warnings and precautions are critical, as well as adverse drug events. We have done a phenomenal job in our care models for trying to minimize the adverse events and the morbidity and even mortality that can be associated with antiretrovirals for HIV, and we're working very hard to do the same with the direct antiretrovirals for hep C. So this remains a very vital part of overall quality of care rendered to our clients. And then access. I mention this because these direct-acting agents have brought great promise and, in fact, delivered on the promise for many patients up to date. Many of you are aware that they represent one of the most expensive treatment regimens released in the U.S., with single-dose tablets of some of these combination regimens being $1,000 a day. So we have regimens that can be $75,000 to $150,000 or more to treat a single patient with direct-acting antiretroviral drugs. Cost varies, as well as the formulary status of these drugs, and so that helps to define the prescriber's decision-making as what's available within the benefits for pharmacy product. I bring up the second step, which is dispensing, and I should have said in the earlier slide, but no need to go back. Prescribers benefit from having electronic prescriptions generated, especially if they allow for drug interaction checking to be done at the e-prescribing environment or electronic health record. Pharmacies have also electronic pharmacy profiles, and drug interaction screening is something that's incumbent and part of the standard of care for pharmacy practice to appropriateness of selection of agents while we're continuing to be responsive to assuring patient access to drugs, both, let's say, in the acute care ambulatory setting as well as they may move through the continuum of care between whether it be incarceration or at a nursing home or to an emergency department or a hospital or a skilled nursing facility. But the dispensation of the drug is a key point where drug interactions can be done that requires a complete and up-to-date patient medication list, including over-the-counter products and herbal products. Something that was on our earlier slide that I did not emphasize is that particularly on ward, which is has been a commonly used herb for management of mood, particularly depression, that is a major inhibitor. Think of it like ritonavir with respect to its drug interaction capabilities. And there are other herbs that we have to concern ourselves with, so that's part of the practice that actually at both prescribing and at dispensing. At transitions in care, we see disruption. One of the most notorious times where disruption in care in terms of drugs and the appropriateness of drugs is at times when they transition, let's say out of the hospital or into the hospital or between care settings or even between providers, change doctors, go to different providers and different prescriptions are generated. And so medication reconciliation is a process that's critical to screening and to maintaining the integrity of the regimens that are deployed for chronic hep C, particularly around the drug interaction concern. We have to be able to communicate with prescribers and other healthcare providers, and providers have to be able to speak to pharmacists, and then patient education needs to be there because we have characterization from our research, both the pharmacokinetic studies done before marketing and what we call phase 1, 2, and 3 trials, and also after marketing and what we call phase 4 or pharmacovigilance trials. But we do need to listen to our patients, and particularly around adverse events, around adherence. It's difficult to determine treatment failure from listening to the patients and the role of the dispenser, but it is something that we're also aware of. And then the education around direct-acting agents, because we have got come out, more to come. They are representing dramatic outcomes, but there are some safety concerns. There's evolving knowledge. Again, we'll use a couple of studies to show that, but with this, something that remains a critical point of optimal health care. But we talked about the prescribing. We talked about the dispensing. The next stage management process is administration. And we have, mostly from our FDA-approved package labeling and guidelines, we get some guidance if there needs to be revisions to that. It typically comes out slowly, but the administration of drug is a point where we do concern ourselves about drug interactions, particularly as it relates to bioavailability or the absorption of drugs. I want to hasten to say that with respect to antiretroviral and direct-acting antiviral drugs, that the administration phase is not a phase where we see a lot of activity on this end, but I do want to share some points that you should check for and be thinking for in regards to interactions that affect absorption. One may be if there's any concomitant medications that should not be administered at the same time. There are plenty of examples of that in antiretroviral, several good examples. One would be Complera or Relptiviran, where protein pump inhibitors like Prilosec and Protonix and Lysa drug just cannot be given with it without impairing absorption and the ability to eradicate the virus. So we do pay attention to that. That's not the case with any of the direct-acting agents to date. Spacing of medication, we ask, is that important? Specifically for the direct-acting agents, we have no strict guidance around that for drug interactions that affect absorption. Called several slides that spoke to whether they should be taken with or without meals. That's an FDA labeling that should be adhered to so that absorption is maximized based on the taking or the not taking with meals. And that's been developed through the drug development process and emerges as part of the approved FDA labeling. If there's any change in daily timing of medication administration that maximizes benefits, then we usually will convey that. That doesn't seem to be the case with this class. As well as if there's any timing of medication administration that minimizes adverse events, such as if it's to be taken with morning or in the afternoon or in the evening. And comes up in clinical practice and may not be readily recognized, often is not, with direct acting agents during the clinical trials that bring the drug to market, is its use in pediatrics, which for which none of these drugs are currently FDA approved, but which there clearly will be tube feeding and how we navigate the administration of drugs, so the absorption, and there's no drug interactions there, swallowing. And then if there's a chance that there's drugs that feel, look, sound alike that could cause medication errors due to drug interactions, then we would pay attention to that. One example of that would be Viekira Pak, which is for hepatitis C. Sounds like the brand name for came on the market not long ago, which is called, and they look very similar when you see the two names side by side. We're coming toward the end. I just want to, well, monitoring is the phase here and speaks to something I think we're readily aware of, which is adherence. We need to monitor for adherence with the direct-acting agents and the co-infected individuals. That includes the ongoing monitoring for the virus, RNA virus, which is typically quantitatively tested. Week 4, reevaluated at week 6, looking for suppression or consideration for stopping the drug or adjusting the therapies. Week 12 is typically, there are some patients for which therapy is required to continue longer, primarily because of things like cirrhosis or transplantation, and those go out typically 24 weeks, but can be as long as 48 weeks, depending on the drug. We also look at other measures a little beyond the scope of the day, but there's other measurements of adherence, such as prescription fill records, refill records, something we refer to in pharmacy as mean possession rates, and then direct observation of whether patients are taking their medications properly. We need to be aware of the toxicities. As I mentioned, that will be something we will note. If drugs are, levels are going up because of drug interactions is clearly one of them, we should be doing laboratory monitoring for those that are recommended by the FDA, such as CBC counts, basal metabolic panels, basic metabolic panels, liver functions, tests, and bilirubins. And then in the case of typically liver enzyme elevations, because we are talking about hepatitis C, that we look very closely at that as part of the disease monitor as well as the drug monitor. And when we see significant elevations in our liver enzymes, such as AST or hyperbilirubinemia, bilirubinemia, which is clearly associated sometimes with antiretrovirals by themselves, such as azithromycin, but they can be worsened in combination with direct-acting agents. That's something that's a point of distinction in terms of monitoring for toxicity. The adverse events here, I think a couple of very broad statements. One is that there is clearly hepatotoxicity risk that is infrequent, but should be thought of with the direct-acting agents and would be one of those things, as I just mentioned, as part of the monitoring that goes on as medication management for detecting drug interactions that could be problematic. Some of the more common ones are listed on the slides, such as fatigue, headache, nausea. In the case of skin reactions or photosensitivity, cimeprevir or Lysios, a problem there. We don't go on that much, but you should be aware of that. And the last one, we have a case to emphasize, but amiodarone, a cardiac drug which is commonly used for arrhythmias, is a problem combination drug, which we'll talk about in a moment with some of our therapies. Okay, a couple of themes to drive home some of what we discuss. Appreciate the potential for drug interactions. This is a study by Patel et al. That was conducted in 2015, where they looked at HIV Hep C co-infected patients in their medical record that they were on, the Lexicomp drug interaction software, which is an authoritative drug interaction screening tool that's used commonly in practice, and they documented how often and what types of contraindicated drug interactions were identified before and after the addition of either cimeprevir or sofosbuvir to the regimen. Before any hepatitis C regimen was introduced to the HIV population, they had 20% of patients had a contraindicated drug interaction noted. The addition of cimeprevir, it went up to 88.4% of patients had a contraindicated drug interaction. Contraindicated in all of our minds that it's not to be given. These two products are not safe to give together, and it's rarely a justification for giving the two together, so they shouldn't be done. So sofosbuvir had a much better story. It went up to 24.5%, consistent with earlier statements I made, which is sofosbuvir is less likely to cause significant drug interactions. Cimeprevir, much more problematic. But the use of drugs for chronic hepatitis C treatment was, in either case, increasing the potential of patients to have contraindicated drug interactions, which brings about safety concerns, as well as diminished efficacy of the drugs to treat the Hep C. So screening is critical in detecting the potential for contraindications before patients are initiated on therapy. This slide is emphasizing how we predict interactions, and I've kind of already went to this point, but I do want to make sure that we again emphasize we have in the FDA labeling, which therefore means will be in all the authoritative references, specific dose adjustment guidelines for certain antiretrovirals which should be followed in clinical practice. If it's not followed, there should be some expert reason why that's not being done. And you see one of the things is to avoid contraindicated drugs, but in the case of where you don't have to avoid drug interactions, such as use with Sustiva or efavirenz, you do have to up the dose to 90 milligrams of Cladisphere per day. Failing to do that would be, in effect, a medical error. Follow FDA labeling around appropriate dosing for drug interactions that have been laid out based on the science. Okay, I earlier mentioned a drug that you may be familiar with, maybe not, called amiodarone. It is the main drug used for management of chronic atrial fibrillation, and it's used for other cardiac arrhythmias. Prior to its release of sofosbuvir or Sovaldi to the market, it was not known that this interaction existed. But now the FDA labeling, as the first bullet notes, that there's a warning of severe bradycardia when administered this agent, sofosbuvir, with amiodarone. Keep in mind, sofosbuvir comes alone. It also comes in combination with Harvoni, and it is part of combination regimens like with the Cladisphere. So it's a popular direct-acting antiviral. The example here is after amiodarone and propranolol were given to a patient, 2 hours later, sofosbuvir and the Cladisphere were started for Hep C, and the patient experienced within that 2-hour period a dramatic drop in their heart rate to 27, knowing that typically 60 or 70 is normal for most of us. They stopped the amiodarone and the propranolol. They continued the direct-acting agents for 3 days. Each time the patient received sofosbuvir with the cladisvir, the bradycardia occurred again. It was only after discontinuation of the direct-acting antivirals that no bradycardic events were observed. 15 days after the patient had stopped the amiodarone and another beta blocker called atenolol, which is another cardiac drug, the patient was challenged again with their sofosbuvir and discladisvir. Bradycardia was again recorded. When we see a rechallenge like this, it becomes highly probable that it's the drug interaction that's causing this. No bradycardic events were observed following a challenge 8 weeks after amiodarone was stopped. So a couple of themes here. Drug comes on the market. We need to remain vigilant about updates to drug interactions and warnings, as in the case of this. Two, important to have those who know about the drug included in the case when this occurs, because amiodarone is a very, very long-acting drug. It takes a long time to come out of the body. So just stopping it and then starting back the direct-acting antivirals would not be sufficient, because it has what we call a half-life of about a month and a half. So it takes a while for the system, the body, to break it down and remove enough of it that it doesn't cause the problem anymore. And just to heighten your awareness on this, so all sofosbuvir-containing regimens now, Harvoni, sofosbuvir with Alisio, sofosbuvir with the cladisvir, any other combinations like that, if someone cannot have amiodarone taken off of their regimen, then they have to be hospitalized to start this combination regimen, monitored, and then they have to be monitored regularly afterwards for several weeks. And this is all based on new FDA labeling. So this is just an example of the not a pharmacokinetic interaction, but a pharmacodynamic interaction, and an example of how new information emerges around drugs, and specifically drugs that have interacting concerns. And then we as a clinical community have to be vigilant, embrace it, employ it. And also we have to be observing it, because fortunately, outside of research, some clinicians recognize this as a probable drug interaction and shared it with the manufacturer, the FDA, and now we're all informed about it. So we have to listen to our patients, especially since we know these are products that have significant potential drug interactions. Before I open for questions, just simply put, there are no direct-acting antivirals for treatment of chronic hepatitis C in the mono-infected or co-infected population that have no drug interactions. They all have some. We saw dramatic variability and good guidance on some of the interactions, but it's not a subject that's one for passive care. It requires engagement on part of the clinical community and the patient, and we need to be vigilant, particularly to avoid missteps with breakdown and transitions of care, because that's often where we see the breakdown after good initial planning, that over time, 8, 12, 24 weeks, things introduced into patients' regimen or behaviors change or clinicians change, and we have varying understanding of what's going on with patient care. And so I would just say, again, all of these drugs have significant interactions. With that, I'll stop, and I'll turn it over to you, Steve, for any questions from the audience.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Keyes. We would like to open it up now for questions and answers. If you have any questions, please type them into the questions pane on the GoToWebinar toolbar. We did have one that came in that reads, have any organizations had any experience with setting up clinical decision support via their EHRs for medication management for HIV and HCV co-infected patients?
That's a great question. I suspect that there's others in the audience who may want to comment. That sounds like a kind of a polling question for the entire body on the call, but I would just share that all EHR records that have e-prescribing capabilities within them, there are only less than a handful of vendors that provide the backbone to electronic prescribing in the United States. And in the electronic prescribing capabilities within the EHRs, I'll just mention one of the major ones, which is First Data Bank, but they're not the only one. They do have drug interaction software capabilities for the HIV and the direct-acting antivirals. A few cautions, though. There's a lot of interactions, and many facilities do things to the clinical decision support, meaning turn off or suppress alerts because there's too many and the physicians or prescribers have great difficulty accepting those as valuable and time efficient. So I just want to share that. So there is that built into e-prescribing capabilities if the clinical support has been introduced and turned on and is useful. I'll leave that thought as it is for any others to type in some other responses.
Okay, if anyone would like to add to that, go ahead and type your comments in the questions pane. I don't see any more questions right now. We can give folks a few minutes.
I also want to mention to our group is that there are some centers that go to great lengths to keep track of these kinds of interactions. One of them is the University of California, San Francisco. They have a website that is a database of antiretroviral adverse drug-drug interactions, and it does include the, can't say includes all, but it includes many of the direct-acting antiretroviral drug interactions. And so I would encourage you to Google it. It's the database of antiretrovirals at University of California, San Francisco, and it's still actively up and running, but it's not integrated in any facility electronic health record that I'm aware of. Maybe it isn't at their institution, but not across the country.
Okay, we have another question. What has been your experience regarding HCV and HIV co-infected patients who have renal failure and receiving dialysis weekly? Treatment successes or drug-drug interaction?
That's an excellent question. Let me go through evidence. From an evidence standpoint, we do not have randomized controlled clinical trials that have sufficiently answered the question of best regimens for treatment of renal failure patients on dialysis with the direct-acting antiretrovirals. Those considerations are mostly expert opinion combined with pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic considerations, which are designed per patient. And so we do have, as we do for antiretrovirals, we do have for some of the direct-acting antivirals for chronic hep C, we have guidance on dose adjustment, but we are weak overall in chronic hep C dose adjustment guidelines for direct-acting antivirals. And so the evidence, I would say, from our standpoint, is primarily clinical case reports, case series, and expert opinion using pharmacokinetic principles for which these drugs have been used. But we are really, I think, overall inadequate because all of these new agents have principally excluded from the trials the population that the questioner posed, which is dialysis patients. So I wish I could add more, but on our personal experience, it's a seldom, we don't even have enough in our practice, enough of them to say we have a case series that we could speak to efficacy, which I think was an important part of the question that was posed. So what is the efficacy? What I would say is that we don't have evidence that they fail. We assume that if we can get therapeutic levels in the range that they will have good sustained response, but it's probably not going to be at the same level that we see in the mono-infected patient or the co-infected HIV patient who doesn't have renal failure.
Okay, and if anyone else has any questions, please enter them into the questions pane right now. We have another minute or so. All right, I'm not seeing any further questions. Did you have any closing thoughts before I close it out here?
I'm just picturing myself in all of the settings where I'm speaking to, and I'm hoping that there is a team engagement where discussion is going on between the different providers, because it's very difficult to successfully do this piece of what we're talking about, the managing of drug interactions, kind of separate and apart from the doctor working with nursing and case managers and pharmacists and patients. So if you find yourself isolated, then reach out to your providers who were doing the phase of the medication management we talked about, the prescribing, the dispensing, the administration, and monitoring, so that you can coalesce around a team dynamic that's pretty essential for successful management of these and to reduce the chance of errors.
All right. I think that will do it. Thank you for participating in today's webinar. We hope that you're able to find the information provided useful as you continue your P4C project. And we ask that you take a few moments to complete the feedback survey that you will receive when you close out of this webinar. You will also receive it in the follow-up email. Today's webinar was recorded, and audio and video versions of the entire webinar will be made available on the P4C website within the next few weeks. Copies of all our prior P4C webinars are currently available on the website on the P4C resource materials page at p4chivtac.com. You will need to log in to access the materials. If you need login credentials, send an email to p4chivtac@myatech.com. Thank you again for participating in today's webinar, and thank you, Dr. Keyes, for that excellent presentation. If you have any additional questions for the P4C project or for Dr. Keyes, please email us at p4chivtac@myatech.com. Take care, everybody, and we'll see you next time.